This is a Vision Australia Radio podcast.
Welcome to Cover to Cover from Vision Australia Radio. I'm Tim McQueen. Cover to Cover is recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the first Australians and traditional owners of the land across our broadcast areas. I pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In this program, I catch up with some poems and haikus from Helen MacDonald that were missed out from the Elwood Writers' Choice program a couple of weeks ago. And Barry Liveney reads The Sister of the Baroness by Catherine Mansfield and Broadway Financier by Damon Runyon.
The Sister of the Baroness by Catherine Mansfield. There are two new guests arriving this afternoon, said the manager of the pension, placing a chair for me at the breakfast table. I have only received the letter acquainting me with the fact this morning. The Baroness von Gaul is sending her little daughter, the poor child is dumb, to make the cure. She is to stay with us a month, and then the Baroness herself is coming. Baroness von Gaul, cried the Frau Doktor, coming into the room and positively scenting the name. Coming here? There was a picture of her only last week in Sport and Salon. She is a friend of the court. I have heard that the Kaiserin says Dieu to her. But this is delightful. I shall take my doctor's advice and spend an extra 6 weeks here. There is nothing like young society. But the child is dumb, ventured the manager apologetically. Bah, what does that matter? Afflicted children have such pretty ways. Each guest who came into the breakfast room was bombarded with the wonderful news. The Baroness von Gaul is sending her little daughter here. The Baroness herself is coming in a month's time. Coffee and rolls took on the nature of an orgy. We positively scintillated. Anecdotes of the high-born were poured out, sweetened and sipped. We gorged on scandals of high birth, generously buttered. They are to have the room next to yours, said the manager, addressing me. I was wondering if you would permit me to take down the portrait of the Kaiserin Elizabeth from above your bed to hang over their sofa. Yes, indeed. Something homelike. The Frau Oberregierungsrat patted my hand. And of no possible significance to you. I felt a little crushed. Not at the prospect of losing that vision of diamonds and blue velvet bust, but at the tone, placing me outside the pale, branding me as a foreigner. We dissipated the day in valid speculations, decided it was too warm to walk in the afternoon, so lay down on our beds, mustering in great force for afternoon coffee. And a carriage drew up at the door. A tall young girl got out, leading a child by the hand. They entered the hall, were greeted and shown to their room. 10 minutes later, she came down with the child to sign the visitor's book. She wore a black, closely fitting dress, touched at throat and wrists with white frilling. Her brown hair, braided, was tied with a black bow, unusually pale, with a small mole on her left cheek. I am the Baroness von Gaul's sister, she said, trying the pen on a piece of blotting paper and smiling at us deprecatingly. Even for the most jaded of us, life holds its thrilling moments. 2 baronesses in 2 months. The manager immediately left the room to find a new nib. To my plebeian eyes, that afflicted child was singularly unattractive. She had the air of having been perpetually washed with a blue bag and hair like grey wool. Dressed, too, in a pinafore so stiffly starched that she could only peer at us over the frill of it. A social barrier of a pinafore. And perhaps it was too much to expect a noble aunt to attend to the menial consideration of her niece's ears. But a dumb niece with unwashed ears struck me as a most depressing object. They were given places at the head of the table. For a moment, we all looked at one another with an "Ina Dina Dina Do" expression. Then the Frau Ober Regierungsrat, "I hope you are not tired after your journey." "No," said the sister of the Baroness, smiling into her cup. "I hope the dear child is not tired," said the Frau Doktor. "Not at all." "I expect, I hope you will sleep well tonight," the Herr Oberlehrer said reverently. "Yes." The poet from Munich never took his eyes off the pair. He allowed his tie to absorb most of his coffee while he gazed at them exceedingly soulfully. "Unyoking Pegasus," thought I. "Death spasms of his odes to solitude." There were possibilities in that young woman for an inspiration, not to mention a dedication, and from that moment his suffering temperament took up its bed and walked. They retired after the meal, leaving us to discuss them at leisure. "There is a likeness," mused the Frau Doktor. "Quite. What a manner she has. Such reserve. Such a tender way with the child." "Pity she has the child to attend to," exclaimed the student from Bonn. He had hitherto relied upon three scars and a ribbon to produce an effect. But the sister of a baroness demanded more than these. Absorbing days followed. Had she been one whit less beautifully born, we could not have endured the continual conversation about her. The songs in her praise, the detailed account of her movements. But she graciously suffered our worship, and we were more than content. The poet she took into her confidence. He carried her books when we went walking. He jumped the afflicted one on his knee. Poetic license, this, and one morning brought his notebook into the salon and read to us. "The sister of the Baroness has assured me she is going into a convent," he said. That made the student from Bonn sit up. "I have written these few lines last night from my window in the sweet night air." "Oh, your delicate chest," commented the Frau Doktor. He fixed a stony eye on her, and she blushed. "I have written these lines. Ah, will you to a convent fly? So young, so fresh, so fair. Spring like a doe upon the fields, and find your beauty there." Nine verses equally lovely commanded her to equally violent action. I am certain that had she followed his advice, not even the remainder of her life in a convent would have given her time to recover her breath. "I have presented her with a copy," he said, "and today we are going to look for wildflowers in the wood." The student from Bonn got up and left the room. I begged the poet to repeat the verses once more. At the end of the sixth verse, I saw from the window the sister of the Baroness and the scarred youth disappearing through the front gate, which enabled me to thank the poet so charmingly that he offered to write me out a copy. But we were living at too high pressure in those days. Swinging from our humble pension to the high walls of palaces, how could we help but fall? Late one afternoon, the Frau Doktor came upon me in the writing room, and took me to her bosom. "She has been telling me all about her life," whispered the Frau Doctor. "She came to my bedroom and offered to massage my arm. You know, I am the greatest martyr to rheumatism. And, fancy now, she has already had 6 proposals of marriage. Such beautiful offers that I assure you I wept, and every one of noble birth. My dear, the most beautiful was in the wood. Not that I do not think a proposal should take place in a drawing room. It is more fitting to have 4 walls. But this was a private wood. He said, the young officer, she was like a young tree whose branches had never been touched by the ruthless hand of man. Such delicacy. She sighed and turned up her eyes. Of course, it is difficult for you English to understand when you are always exposing your legs on cricket fields and breeding dogs in your back garden. The pity of it. Youth should be like a wild rose. For myself, I do not understand how your women ever get married at all. She shook her head so violently that I shook mine too, and a gloom settled round my heart. It seemed we were really in a very bad way. Did the spirit of romance spread her rose wings only over aristocratic Germany? I went to my room, bound a pink scarf about my hair, and took a volume of Moriki's lyrics into the garden. A great bush of purple lilac grew behind the summer house. There I sat down, finding a sad significance in the delicate suggestion of half mourning. I began to write a poem myself. They sway and languish dreamily, and we, close pressed, are kissing there. It ended. Close pressed did not sound at all fascinating. Savored of wardrobes. Did my wild rose then already trail in the dust? I chewed a leaf and hugged my knees. Then, in a magic moment, I heard voices from the summer house, the sister of the Baroness and the student from Bonn. Second hand was better than nothing. I pricked up my ears. "What small hands you have," said the student from Bonn. "They were like white lilies lying in the pool of your black dress." This certainly sounded the real thing. Her high-born reply was what interested me. Sympathetic murmur only. "May I hold one?" I heard 2 sighs. Presumed they held. He had rifled those dark waters of a noble bosom. "Look at my great fingers besides yours." "But they are beautifully kept," said the sister of the Baroness shyly. The minx! Was love then a question of manicure? "How I should adore to kiss you," murmured the student. "But you know I am suffering from severe nasal catarrh, and I dare not risk giving it to you. 16 times last night did I count myself sneezing, and 3 different handkerchiefs." I threw Moriki into the lilac bush and went back into the house. A great automobile snorted at the front door. In the salon, great commotion. The Baroness was paying a surprise visit to her little daughter. Clad in a yellow mackintosh, she stood in the middle of the room questioning the manager. And every guest the pension contained was grouped about her, even the Frau Doktor, presumably examining a timetable as near to the august skirts as possible. "But where is my maid?" asked the Baroness. "There was no maid," replied the manager, "save for your gracious sister and daughter." "Sister?" she cried sharply. "Fool, I have no sister. My child travelled with the daughter of my dressmaker." Tableau grandissimo. That was The Sister of the Baroness by Catherine Mansfield.
Here's Helen MacDonald.
Missing. A sadness with the weight of a duvet, wrapped in the ache of a missing, a warmth in the heaviness of memory, trapped in the threads. Ghost gums stripped bare, we leave as we arrive. We leave as we arrive, stripped bare. Ghost gums. Restoration. I wish I had a broom and could climb mini-sized into your beautiful brain to scrub and clean punctured vessels and take a tiny needle and thread, sew up the holes and make it perfect again. Your beautiful brain, shuddering in spasms, darting down, down extremities to shut them down, sever sensation. Let slip the beauty of a full curved lip. Give me needle and thread, and I will repair, remake you with your sharp, clear thoughts. Magician, solver of problems. The gods are jealous, but we don't let them near. We adapt, deflect, adapt again. Whatever they hurl, we dodge and weave, and nothing rocks us. Make me tiny, my fingers swift. Let me repair you and defeat the gods again. Ambulance siren, the sounds of children playing. Breaking up. We've parted company. It's official. I've tried, I really have. It's time to go our separate ways, no longer in tune, out of sync. I don't recognize you propelling off in another direction. I don't want to follow. We've had a lifetime of ups and downs, but we managed to overcome niggling discrepancies. My putting up with your failures, soldiering through, you've let me down often. But my eyes were fixed on the future, always with the hope we would reconnect in harmony. It's worked till now. Once nothing could separate us. Now I'm tired. I've given up. I can't hang on, dragging your brokenness. So I'm taking my outward face, my will, going it alone, chin up, determined, armed and shaking. My body and I, we've parted company. Let it be me that prevails. A couple on either side of the track. Pine needles. The way. The way when in time's dark to gaze at moonshine, even a sliver jeweled by the stars until there is nothing else, everything settles. Complete connection, a body can transcend the pain, the fear. The way a certain note blown through a Tibetan flute flows and resonates the same vibration, this note and a being responding in harmony, depths seldom reached. The way a painting draws you into that moment of creation, observing the artist's mind. Two as one, existing only while the other is present. Everything falls away.
Thank you, Helen.
Broadway Financier by Damon Runyon. Of all the scores made by dolls on Broadway the past 25 years, there is no doubt but what the very largest score is made by a doll who is called Silk, when she knocks off a banker by the name of Israel Ibb. For the size of Silk's score is 3,100,000 bobs and a few odd cents. It is admitted by one and all who know about these matters that the record up to this time is held by a doll by the name of Irma Teek, who knocks off a Russian duke back in 1911, when Russian dukes are considered very useful by dolls. Although, of course, in these days, Russian dukes are about as useful as dandruff. Anyway, Irma Teek's score off this Russian duke is up around 1,000,000, and she moves to London with her duke and chucks quite a swell around there for a time. But finally, Irma Teek goes blind, which is a tough break for her, as she can no longer see how jealous she is making other dolls with her diamonds and sables and one thing and another. So what good are they to her, after all? I know Irma Teek when she is a show doll at the old Winter Garden, and I also know the doll by the name of Maisie Mitz, who is a Floradora revival, and who makes a score of maybe 300 G's off a guy who has a string of 10-cent stores, and 300 G's is by no means hay. But Maisie Mitz finally hauls off and runs away with a saxophone player she is in love with, and so winds up back of the 15 ball. Furthermore, I know Clara Simmons, the model from Rickson's, who gets a 5-story townhouse and a country place on Long Island off a guy in Wall Street for birthday presents. And while I never meet this guy personally, I always figure he must be very dumb, because anybody who knows Clara Simmons knows she will be just as well satisfied with a bottle of perfume for a birthday present. For all I know, Clara Simmons may still own the townhouse and the country place, but she must be shoving on towards 40 now, so naturally nobody on Broadway cares what becomes of her. I know 100 other dolls who run up different scores, and some of them are very fair scores indeed. But none of these scores are anything much alongside Silk's score off Israel Ibb. And this score is all the more surprising because Silk starts out being greatly prejudiced against bankers. I am no booster for bankers myself, as I consider them very stony-hearted guys. But I am not prejudiced against them. In fact, I consider bankers very necessary, because if we do not have bankers, many citizens will not be able to think of anybody to give a check on. It is quite a while before she meets Israel Ibb that Silk explains to me why she is prejudiced against bankers. It is when she is nothing but a chorus doll in Johnny Oakley's joint on 53rd Street, and comes into Mindy's after she gets through work, which is generally along about 4 o'clock in the morning. At such an hour, many citizens are sitting around Mindy's resting from the crap games and one thing and another. And dolls from the different joints around and about, including chorus dolls and hostesses, drop in for something to eat before going home. And generally these dolls are still in their makeup and very tired. Naturally, they come to know the citizens who are sitting around and say hello, and maybe accept the hospitality of these citizens, such as Java and Danish pastry, or maybe a few scrambled eggs. And it is all very pleasant and harmless, because a citizen who is all tuckered out from shooting craps is not going to get any high blood pressure over a tired chorus doll or a hostess, and especially a hostess. Well, one morning Silk is sitting at my table guzzling a cup of Java and a piece of apple pie, when in comes the Greek, looking very weary. The Greek, being a high shot who is well known far and wide. He drops into a chair alongside me and orders a Bismarck herring with sliced onions to come along, which is a dish that is considered most invigorating. And then the Greek mentions that he is playing the bank for 24 hours and running. So right away, Silk speaks up as follows. "I hate banks," she says. "Furthermore," she says, "I hate bankers. If it is not for a banker, maybe I will not be slaving in Johnny Oakley's dirty little drum for 30 bobs per week. Maybe my mama will still be alive, and I will be living at home with her instead of in a flea bag in 47th Street. My mama once saves up 300 bobs from scrubbing floors in an office building to send me to school, Silk says. And a banker in one of the buildings where she does this scrubbing tells her to put her dough in his bank. And what happens? But the bank busts, and it is such a terrible blow to my mama that she ups and dies. I am very small at the time, Silk says, but I can remember standing in front of the busted bank with my mama, and my mama crying her eyes out. Well, personally, I consider Silk's crack about Johnny Oakley's joint uncalled for, as it is by no means little. But I explain to her that what the Greek is talking about is a faro bank, and not a bank you put money in, as such a bank is called a jug, and not a bank at all, while faro bank is a gambling game. And the reason I explain this to Silk is because everybody always explains things to her. The idea is everybody wishes Silk to be well smartened up, especially everybody who hangs out around Mindy's because she is an orphan and never has a chance to go to school. And we do not wish her to grow up dumb like the average doll, as one and all are very fond of Silk from the first minute she bobs up around Mindy's. Now at this time, Silk is maybe 17 years old and weighs maybe 90 pounds, sopping wet, and she is straight up and down like a boy. She has soft brown hair and brown eyes that seem too big for her face. And she looks right at you when she talks to you, and she talks to you like one guy to another guy. In fact, I always claim there is more guy in Silk than there is doll, as she finally gets so she thinks like a guy, which is maybe because she associates more with guys than she does with other dolls, and gets a guy's slant on things in general. She loves to sit around Mindy's in the early morning, gabbing with different citizens, although she does more listening than gabbing herself. And she loves to listen to gab about horse racing and baseball and fights and crapshooting and to guys cutting up old touches and whatever else is worth gabbing about. And she seldom sticks in her oar, except maybe to ask a question. Naturally, a doll who is willing to listen instead of wishing to gab herself is bound to be popular, because if there is anything most citizens hate and despise, it is a gabby doll. So then, many citizens take a real interest in Silk's education, including Regret, the horse player, who explains to her how to build up a sucker to betting on a hot horse. Although personally I do not consider such knowledge of any more value to a young doll just starting out in the world than the lesson Big Nig, the crapshooter, gives her one night on how to switch in a pair of tops on a crap game. Then there is Doc Darrow, who is considered one of the highest class operators that ever rides the tubs in his day, being a great hand for travelling back and forth across the ocean and outplaying other passengers at bridge and poker and one thing and another, but who finally gets rheumatism in his hands so bad he can no longer shuffle the cards. And of course, if Doc Darrow cannot shuffle the cards, there is no sense whatever in him trying to play games of skill anymore. Doc Darrow is always telling Silk what rascals guys are and explaining to her the different kinds of business they will try to give her, this being the same kind of business the Doc gives dolls himself in his time. The Doc has an idea that a young doll who is battling Broadway needs plenty of education along such lines, but Silk tells me privately that she is Jerry to the stuff Doc is telling her when she is 5 years old. The guy I figure does Silk the most good is an old pappy guy by the name of Professor D, who is always reading books when he is not busy doping the horses. In fact, Professor D is considered somewhat daffy on the subject of reading books, but it seems he gets the habit from being a teacher in a college out in Ohio before he becomes a horse player. Anyway, Professor D takes to giving Silk books to read, and what is more, she reads them and talks them over afterward with the professor, who is greatly pleased by this. She is a bright little doll, Professor D says to me one day. Furthermore, the professor says, she has soul. Well, I say, Big Nig claims she can palm a pair of dice as good as anybody he ever sees. But the professor only says, hi-ho, and goes along. And I can see he does not consider me a character worth having much truck with, even though I am as much interested in Silk's education as anybody else. Well, what happens one night but the regular singer in Johnny Oakley's joint, a doll by the name of Myrtle Marigold, hauls off and catches the measles from her 12-year-old son. And as Johnny has enough trouble getting customers into his joint without giving them the measles after getting them there, he gives Myrtle Marigold plenty of wind at once. But there he is without anybody to sing Stacker Lee to his customers. Stacker Lee being a ditty with which Myrtle Marigold panics the customers. So Johnny looks his chorus over and finally asks Silk if she can sing. And Silk says she can sing all right, but that she will not sing Stacker Lee, because she considers it a low-down lullaby at best. She says she will sing something classical and, being desperate for singing, Johnny Oakley says go ahead. So what does Silk do but sing a very old song called Annie Laurie, which she learns from her mama. And she sings this song so loud that sobs are heard all over the joint. Of course, if anybody investigates, they will learn that the sobbing is being done by Professor D and Big Nig and the Greek, who happen to be in the joint at the time. And what they are sobbing about is the idea of Silk singing at all. But Johnny Oakley considers her a big hit and keeps her singing Annie Laurie right along. And one night, Harry Fitz, the booking agent, drops in and hears her singing and tells Ziegfeld he discovers a doll with a brand new style. Naturally, Ziggy signs her up at once for the Follies, because he has great faith in Harry Fitz's judgment. But after Ziggy hears Silk sing, he asks her if she can do anything else, and is greatly relieved when he learns she can dance. So Silk becomes a Ziegfeld dancer. And she is quite a sensation with the dramatic critics on the night she opens, because she dances with all her clothes on, which is considered a very great novelty indeed. The citizens around Mindy's chip in and send Silk a taxicab full of orchids and a floral pillow. And Professor D contributes a book called The Outline of History. And Silk is the happiest doll in town. A year goes by. And what a year in the Follies does for Silk is most astonishing. Personally, I never see a lot of change in her looks, except her figure fills out so it has bumps here and there where a doll is entitled to have bumps, and her face grows to fit her eyes more. But everybody else claims she becomes beautiful, and her picture is always in the papers, and dozens of guys are always hanging around after her and sending her flowers and one thing and another. One guy in particular starts sending her jewelry, which Silk always brings around to Mindy's for Jewelry Joe to look at. This Jewelry Joe being a guy who peddles jewelry along Broadway for years, and who can tell you in a second what a piece of jewelry is worth. Jewelry Joe finds that the jewelry Silk brings around is nothing much but slum. And naturally, he advises her to have no further truck with any party who cannot send in anything better than this. But one morning, she shows up in Mindy's with an emerald ring the size of a cake of soap. And the minute Jewelry Joe sees the emerald, he tells Silk that whoever donates this is worthy of very careful attention. Now, it seems that the party who sends the emerald is nobody but Israel Ibb, the banker who owns the jug down on the Lower East Side that is called the Bank of the Bridges. And the way Silk comes to connect with him is most unusual. It is through a young guy by the name of Simeon Slotsky, who is a teller in Israel Ibb's jug, and who sees Silk dancing one night in the Follies and goes right off his kazip about her. It is this Simeon Slotsky who is sending the jewelry that Silk first brings around. And the way he is buying this jewelry is by copping a little dough out of the jug now and then, which does not belong to him. Naturally, this is a most dishonest action, and by they catch up with Simeon Slotsky in the jug, and Israel Ibb is going to place him in the pokey. Well, Simeon Slotsky does not wish to be placed in the pokey, and not knowing what else to do, what does he do but go to Silk and tell her his story, explaining that he commits this dishonest business only because he is daffy about her, even though Silk never gives him a tumble, and in fact never says as much as two words to him before. He tells her that he comes of respectable old parents down on the Lower East Side, who will be very sad if he is placed in the pokey, especially his mama. But Israel Ibb is bound and determined to put him away, because Israel Ibb is greatly opposed to anybody copping dough out of his jug. Simeon Slotsky says his mama cries all over Israel Ibb's vest, trying to cry him out of the idea of placing her son in the pokey, but that Israel Ibb is a very hard-hearted guy and will not give in no matter what. And furthermore, he is very indignant because Simeon's mama's tears spot up his vest. So Simeon says it looks as if he must go to the pokey unless Silk can think of something. Now Silk is very young herself and very tender-hearted, and she is sorry for Simeon Slotsky, because she can see he is nothing but 100% chump. So she sits down and writes a letter to Israel Ibb, asking him to call on her backstage at the Follies on a matter of great importance. Of course, Silk does not know that it is not the proper caper to be writing a banker such a letter, and ordinarily it is 1,000 to 1, according to the way the Greek figures the odds, that a banker will pay no attention to such a letter except maybe to notify his lawyer. But it seems that the letter tickles Israel Ibb, as he always secretly wishes to get a peek backstage at the Follies to see if the dolls back there wear as few clothes as he hears. So he shows up the very same night, and in 5 minutes, Silk has him all rounded up as far as Simeon Slotsky is concerned. Israel Ibb says he will straighten out everything and send Simeon to a job in a jug out west. So the next day, Simeon Slotsky comes around and thanks Silk for all she does for him, and bawls quite some, and gets a photograph of her with her name signed to it, which he says he will give to his mama so she can stick it up on her wall on the east side to always remember the doll who saves her son. And then Simeon Slotsky goes on about his business, and for all I know, becomes a very honest and useful citizen. And 48 hours later, Silk is wearing the emerald from Israel Ibb. Now this Israel Ibb is by no means a Broadway character, and in fact few ever hear of him before he bobs up sending Silk an emerald ring. In fact, it seems that Israel Ibb is a quiet, industrious guy who has nothing on his mind but running his jug and making plenty of scratch until the night he goes to see Silk. He is a little short, fat guy of maybe 40-odd at this time, with a little round stomach sticking out in front of him, and he always wears a white vest on his stomach, with a pair of gold-rimmed cheetahs hanging on a black ribbon across the vest. He has a large schnozzle and is as homely as a mud fence, any way you take him, but it is well known to one and all that he is a coming guy in the banking dodge. Silk is always making jokes about Israel Ibb, because naturally she cannot see much to such a looking guy. But every morning she comes into Mindy's with all kinds of swag, such as bracelets and rings and brooches, and Jewelry Joe finally speaks to her very severely and tells her that a guy who can send her such merchandise is no joking matter. There is no doubt that Israel Ibb is dizzy about her, and personally I consider it very sad that a guy as smart as he must be lets himself get tangled up in such a situation. But then I remember that guys 10,000 times smarter than Israel Ibb let themselves get tangled up the same way. So it is all even. The upshot of the whole business is that Silk begins to pay a little serious attention to Israel Ibb. And the next thing anybody knows, she quits the Follies and takes to living in a large apartment on Park Avenue and riding around in a big car with a guy in uniform driving her. And she has enough fur coats for a tribe of Eskimos, including a chinchilla flogger that moves Israel back 30 Gs. Furthermore, it comes out that the apartment house she is living in is in her own name. And some citizens are greatly surprised, as they do not figure a doll just off Broadway smart enough to get anything in her own name, except maybe a traffic summons. But Professor D says he is not surprised because he once makes Silk read a book entitled The Importance of Property. We do not see much of Silk anymore these days, but every now and then we hear rumours of her getting more apartment houses and business buildings in her own name. And the citizens around Mindy's are greatly pleased because they figure it proves that the trouble they take educating Silk is by no means wasted. Finally, we hear Silk goes to Europe, and for nearly 2 years she is living in Paris and other spots. And some say the reason she sticks around Europe is because she finds out all of a sudden that Israel Ibb is a married guy. Although personally I figure Silk must know this all along, because it certainly is no mystery. In fact, Israel Ibb is very much married, indeed, and his ever-loving wife is a big fat old doll whose family has plenty of potatoes. The chances are Silk is sick and tired of looking at Israel Ibb, and stays abroad so she will not have to look at his ugly kisser more than 2 or 3 times a year, which is about as often as Israel Ibb can think up excuses to go over and see her. Then one winter we hear that Silk is coming home to stay. And it is the winter of 1930, when things are very tough indeed. It is close to Christmas when Silk lands one morning around 11 o'clock from the steamship, and it seems she is expecting Israel Ibb to meet her at the dock. But Israel Ibb is not present, and nobody else is there to tell her why Israel Ibb is absent. It seems that some of Silk's luggage is being held up by the customs guys, and she brings over enough merchandise of one kind and another to stock a department store, and she wishes to see Israel Ibb to get this matter straightened out, so she hires a taxi and tells the jockey to take her to Israel Ibb's jug, figuring to stop in a minute and give Israel Ibb his instructions, and maybe a good rousting around for not meeting her. Now Silk never before goes to Israel Ibb's jug, which is deep down on the Lower East Side, where many citizens wear long whiskers and do not speak much English, and where there always seems to be a smell of herring around and about. And she is greatly surprised and much disgusted by her surroundings as she approaches the corner where Israel Ibb's jug stands. Furthermore, she is much surprised to find a big crowd in front of the jug. And this crowd is made up of many whiskers and old dolls wearing shawls over their heads, and kids of all sizes and shapes. And everybody in the crowd seems much excited. And there is plenty of moaning and groaning from one and all, and especially from an old doll who is standing in the doorway of a little store a couple of doors from the jug. In fact, this old doll is making more racket than all the rest of the crowd put together, and at times is raising her voice to a scream and crying out in a strange language words that sound quite hostile. Silk's taxi cannot get through the mob, and a copper steps up and tells the driver he better make a detour. So Silk asks the copper why these people are raising such a rumpus in the street, instead of being home keeping warm, for it is colder than a blonde's heart, and there is plenty of ice around. "Why," the copper says, "do you not hear? This jug bust this morning, and the guy who runs it, Israel Ibb, is over in the tombs, and the people are nervous because many of them have their potatoes in the jug. In fact," the copper says, "some of them, including the old doll over there in front of the store who was doing all the screeching, have their lifetime savings in this jug, and it looks as if they are ruined. It is very sad," he says, "because they are very, very poor people." And then tears come to his eyes, and he boffs an old guy with whiskers over the skull with his club because the old guy is moaning so loud the copper can scarcely make himself heard. Now, naturally, all this is most surprising news to Silk. And while she was pretty much sawed up because she cannot see Israel Ibb to get her merchandise out of the customs, she has the taxi jockey take her away from these scenes right away and up to her apartment in Park Avenue, which she has ready for her coming home. Then she sends out for the early editions of the evening papers and reads all about what a rapscallion Israel Ibb is for letting his jug bust right in the poor people's faces. It seems that Israel Ibb is placed in the tombs because somebody suspects something illegal about the busting. But of course nobody figures Israel Ibb will be kept in the tombs long on account of being a banker. And in fact, there is already some talk that the parties who placed him there in the first place may find themselves in plenty of heat later on, because it is considered most discourteous to a banker to place him in the tombs, where the accommodations are by no means first class. One of the papers has a story about Israel Ibb's ever-loving wife taking it on the lam as soon as the news gets out about the jug busting and Israel Ibb being in the tombs, and about her saying he can get out of this predicament the best way he can, but that she will never help with as much as a thin dime of her dough, and hinting pretty strong that Israel Ibb's trouble is on account of him squandering the jug's scratch on a doll. The story says she is going back to her people, and from the way the story reads, it sounds as if the scribe who writes it figures this is one good break, at least for Israel Ibb. Now, these hints let out by Israel Ibb's ever-loving wife about him squandering the jug's scratch on a doll are printed as facts in the morning papers the next morning. And maybe if Silk bothers to read these morning sheets, she will think better of going down to Israel Ibb's jug again, because her name is mentioned right out, and there are big pictures of her in the papers from her old days in the Follies. But there Silk is in a taxi in front of the bank of the bridges at 9 o'clock the next morning, and it seems her brain is buzzing with quite a large idea, although this idea does not come out until later. There is already quite a crowd around the jug again, as it is always very difficult to make people who live on the Lower East Side and wear whiskers and shawls understand about such matters as busted jugs. They are apt to hang around a busted jug for days at a time with their bank books in their hands, and sometimes it takes as much as a week to convince such people that their potatoes are gone for good and make them disperse to their homes and start saving more. There is still much moaning and groaning, though not as much as the day before, and every now and then the old doll pops out of the little store and stands in the doorway and shakes her fist at the busted jug and hollers in a strange language. A short, greasy-looking guy with bristly whiskers and an old black derby hat jammed down over his ears is standing with a morning paper spread out in his hands, and a bunch of other guys are around him listening to him read what the paper has to say about the situation. Just one copper is walking up and down now, and it is the copper who speaks to Silk the day before, and he seems to remember her as she gets out of the taxi, and he walks over to her, while a lot of people stop moaning and groaning to take a gander at her. For it is by no means a common sight to see such a looking doll in this neighbourhood. The copper no more than says good morning to Silk when the guy who is reading the paper stops reading and takes a peek at her, and then at her picture, which is on the page in front of him. Then he points at the picture and points at Silk, and begins jabbering a blue streak to the guys around him. About this time, the old doll peeps out of the store to shake her fist at Israel Ibb's jug again, and, hearing the jabbering, she joins the bunch around the guy with the paper. She listens to the jabbering a while, peeking over the guy's shoulder at the picture, and then taking a good long look at Silk. And then all of a sudden the old doll turns and pops back into the store. Now all the shawls and whiskers start gathering around Silk and the copper, and anybody can tell from the way they are looking that they are all sawed up, and what they are sawed up at is silk, because naturally they figure out that she is the doll whose picture is in the morning paper and is therefore the doll who is responsible for Israel Ibs' jug busting. But of course, the copper does not know that they are sawed up at silk and figures they are gathering around just out of curiosity, as people will do when they see a copper talking to anybody. He is a young copper, and naturally he does not wish to have an audience when he is speaking to such a looking doll as Silk. Even if most of the audience cannot understand English, so as the crowd nudges closer, he gets his club ready to boff a few skulls. Just about then, half a brickbat hits him under the right ear, and he begins wobbling about very loose at the hinges. And at the same minute, all the shawls and whiskers take to pulling and hauling at Silk. There are about 100 of the shawls and whiskers to begin with, and more are coming up from every which direction, and they are all yelling and screaming and punching and scratching at Silk. She is knocked down 2 or 3 times, and many shawls and whiskers are walking up and down her person while she is on the ground, and she is bleeding here and there. And the chances are they will kill her as dead as a doornail in their excitement if the old doll from the little store near the jug does not bob up all of a sudden with a mop handle in her duke and starts boffing the shawls and whiskers on their noggins. In fact, the old doll plays a regular tune on these noggins with the mop handle, sometimes knocking a shawl or whiskers quite bow-legged, and soon clearing a path through the crowd to Silk and taking hold of Silk and dragging her off into the store just as the reserves and an ambulance arrive. The young copper is still wobbling about from the brickbat and speaking of how he hears the birdies singing in the trees, although of course there are no birdies in this neighbourhood at such a time of year, and no trees either. And there are maybe 6 shawls and whiskers sitting on the pavement rubbing their noggins, and others are diving into doorways here and there, and there is much confusion generally. So the ambulance takes Silk and some of the shawls and whiskers to a hospital, and Professor D and Doc Darrow visit her there a couple of hours later, finding her in bed, somewhat plastered up in spots, but in no danger, and naturally Professor D and Doc Darrow wish to know what she is doing around Israel Ibs' jug anyway. "Why?" Silk says. "I am not able to sleep a wink all last night thinking of those poor people suffering on account of me taking Israel Ibs' dough. Although," Silk says, "of course I do not know it is wrong dough when I receive it. I do not know Israel Ibs is clipping these poor people. But seeing them around the jug yesterday morning, I remember what happens to my poor mama when the jug busts on her. I see her standing in front of the busted jug with me beside her, crying her eyes out. My heart is very heavy," Silk says. "So I get to thinking," she says, "that it will be a very nice thing indeed if I am first to tell the poor souls who have their dough in Israel Ibs' jug that they are going to get it back." "Wait a minute," Doc Darrow says. "What do you mean they are going to get their dough back?" "Why?" Silk says. "I consult with Judge Goldstein, who is my tongue and a very good guy at that, and fairly honest, last night, and Judge Goldstein tells me that I am worth in negotiable securities and real estate and jewellery and one thing and another about 3,100,000 bobs and a few odd cents. Judge Goldstein tells me," Silk says, "that such a sum will more than pay off all the depositors in Israel Ibs' jug. In fact, Judge Goldstein tells me that what I have probably represents most of the deposits in the jug and," she says, "I sign everything I own in this world over to Judge Goldstein to do this. Although Judge Goldstein says there is no doubt I can beat any attempt to take my dough away from me if I wish to keep it. So," Silk says, "I am so happy to think these poor people will get their dough back that I cannot wait for Judge Goldstein to let it out. I wish to break the news to them myself. But," Silk says, "before I can say a word, they hop on me and start giving me a pasting. And if it is not for the old doll with the mop handle, maybe you will have to chip in to bury me, because I certainly do not have enough dough left to bury myself." Well, this is about all there is to this story. except that the Bank of the Bridges pays off 100% on the dollar, and what is more, Israel Ibb is running it again, and doing very well indeed, and his ever-loving wife returns to him, and everything is hotsy-totsy between them. As for Silk, she is back on Broadway, and the last time I see her, she is in love with a very legitimate guy who is in the hotel business. And while he does not strike me as having much brains, he has plenty of youth running for him. And Silk says it is the best break she ever gets in her life when Israel Ibb's jug busts. But anybody will tell you that the best break Silk ever gets is when the old doll on the Lower East Side recognizes her from the photograph she has stuck up on the wall in the little store near Israel Ibb's jug, as the doll who once saves her son, Simeon Slotsky, from being placed in the pokey. And that was Broadway Financier by Damon Runyon.
And that's all in this edition of Cover to Cover. My thanks to Helen MacDonald and Barry Leveny for their readings. Join me again next week when Trish Nankervell reads Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and I read Ship to Shore by Georgia Blaine and A Brief History of the Trans-Pacific Tunnel by Ken Liu. In the meantime, keep listening to your local RPH network station for informative and interesting programs. I'm Tim McQueen. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this Vision Australia Radio podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. Visit varadio.org for more.
Vision Australia Radio.
Blindness. Low vision.
Opportunity.